I'm Kevin Middleton.
And I'm Samantha Berg. And this is The Bridge to Everywhere. Welcome to The Bridge to Everywhere. Join us as we explore health, community, and culture from a holistic perspective. Health topics addressed on our show are for information and entertainment and should not be taken as medical advice. If you have a medical condition, please consult an appropriate care provider.
Hello, everyone. Thank you for joining us tonight. I'm Kevin Middleton, and I'm here with Samantha Berg. Tonight, we have New York Times bestselling author David Kirby joining us from Brooklyn, New York, to take an in-depth look at the vast, widespread, and mostly unknown collateral damage caused by industrial factory farming. In particular, we want to look at what factory farming is and its threat to human health and the environment across the nation and worldwide. We also want to explore the ethical and moral breaches that lie at the heart of this industry that threaten the health of you and your family. As an example, U.S. animal factories yield 100 times more waste than all U.S. human sewage plants. Human sewage is treated to kill pathogens, but animal waste is not. And as an example within that, hog manure has 10 to 100 times more pathogens than human waste. And manure contains and can contain deadly pathogens, antibiotics, drug-resistant bacteria, hormones, heavy metals, ammonium, hydrogen sulfide, etc. And all of this can seriously impact human health. And agricultural waste is the top cause of well water contaminants in the U.S. At least 4.5 million Americans are exposed to dangerously high nitrate levels in their drinking water. And this can seriously threaten the health of pregnant women. As a side note, if you have questions for David, we really encourage you to join in the conversation. Write your questions on our Bridge to Everywhere Facebook page, and David will answer them on the air.
So before we bring David on, I just want to read you some of his bio, because it's pretty extensive, and David's done a lot of different things, so I want to give you sort of an idea of the breadth and scope of the kinds of things that he's done. So David Kirby is the author of Evidence of Harm, which was a New York Times bestseller, winner of the 2005 Investigative Reporters and Editors Award for Best Book, and a finalist for the New York Public Library Helen Bernstein Award for Excellence in Journalism, and that book was about vaccines, and also Animal Factory, which is the book we're going to discuss tonight, an acclaimed investigation into the environmental impact of factory farms, which NPR compared to Upton Sinclair's classic work, The Jungle. His latest book, Death at SeaWorld, which I'm going to give a plug for because I'm in it, it's awesome, was previewed by Library Journal, which wrote, "Lives are at stake here, and Kirby can be trusted to tell the story, having won a Pacelle of awards for his investigative work." Booklist called the book gripping and hard to put down, while Luis Sahoyas, director of The Cove, labeled it entertaining, engaging, and enraging. An article Kirby wrote for Discover magazine, Made in China, Our Toxic Imported Air Pollution, is included in the Best American Science and Nature Writing 2012, edited with an introduction by Dan Ehrlich. Kirby's also been a regular contributor to the Huffington Post since its founding in 2005, and he's been a professional journalist for more than 20 years. He's written for a number of national magazines and was a foreign correspondent in Mexico and Central America from 1986 to 1990, where he covered the wars in El Salvador and Nicaragua and also covered politics, corruption, and natural disasters in Mexico. He's also done extensive consulting with the United Nations Development Program's Human Development Report Office and UNESCO. Kirby also worked for New York City Council President Carol Bellamy as a special assistant for healthcare, cultural affairs, and civil rights, followed by employment as a chief scheduler to Manhattan Borough President David N. Dinkins and senior staff advisor to Dinkins' successful 1989 run for mayor of New York City. From 1990 to 93, Kirby was director of public information at the American Foundation for AIDS Research, AMFAR, where he acted as press spokesman for Chairwoman Elizabeth Taylor and witnessed firsthand the inner workings of Congress, the White House, and powerful federal agencies like the FDA, CDC, and NIH. Kirby has appeared on such national and international programs as Meet the Press, Larry King Live, The Today Show, NPR, AC360 with Anderson Cooper, MSNBC, BBC Panorama, BBC Two, Fox Channel, Fox and Friends Weekend, I Miss in the Morning, The View, Montel Williams, Air America, and dozens of local radio and television stations. Kirby has also contributed to, been interviewed by, or reviewed by outlets such as the New York Times, Washington Post, USA Today, Associated Press, Financial Times, O Magazine, Bloomberg, Newsday, The Lancet, Salon.com, NPR.com, and much more. And he's also writing for TakePart.com. I didn't see that on that list. Wow. Oh, my God.
So David Kirby, thank you for joining us.
Thank you
tonight.
So much for being here, David.
I've been busy, haven't I?
You have been really busy. That is the longest bio I think I've ever read.
No wonder I'm tired.
Uh-huh. Well, it is 11 o'clock at night in New York, so we really appreciate you staying awake for us.
Sure. Nice to talk to you guys.
Well, maybe you can start with just introducing what is animal factory farming and just give us a little bit of the scope and breadth of the industry.
And you use the term CAFO in the book a lot, so I just wanted to find that for our readers.
Sure, because factory farming, I originally thought factory farming, for some reason, referred to mechanized giant vegetable farms, like giant lettuce farms out in the desert. But it does refer to animal farming or animal production. And the term CAFO actually is really instructive and illustrative. CAFO stands for Concentrated Animal Feeding Operation, and that's the official government designation for these things. And when you consider each of those words separately, it's quite interesting. I mean, animal, as far as I'm concerned, there's nothing wrong with raising animals. I'm not a vegetarian, and we have raised animals for 10,000 years or so as part of our agriculture, so it's part of who we are to raise animals for food. I don't have a problem with that. Feeding, you have to feed your animals, or operation is also a fairly benign word. When you have an operation, that's just a farm, so a animal operation is an animal farm. But the fact that feeding comes into it, that really tells us a lot. Feeding means that the sole purpose of this operation is to get that animal from birth to market as quickly as possible. And, of course, the real devil in this little acronym is the C word, mm-hmm. and the concentrated. And when you put that many animals into that small of space, when your number one goal is to feed them as quickly and efficiently as possible, it's called a conversion ratio, so that for every pound of food you give them, they gain, let's say, a half a pound in body weight. And there, of course, are drugs and other things to help facilitate that. Then you are so far removed from what we think of as a farm that it becomes industrialized animal production, and it becomes a factory. It is a factory. It is mechanized. It is highly energy concentrated. It depends on technology, and it has nothing to do with animal welfare or raising animals in any type of natural environment. Profit is the number one motivation, and the inputs and outputs are calculated on a computer so that they can figure out that we can raise, in this scale, in this vast economy of scale, we can raise 10,000 chickens for 50 cents a chicken, whereas if we only raised 1,000 chickens, it would cost us $1 a chicken. And that's basically the economic principle behind the whole thing.
So a lot of what's driving this, I mean, this is about Americans getting cheap food and having access to cheap food.
And it's beyond Americans, isn't it?
Yeah.
Well, cheap animal protein. Mm-hmm. And this is something that we may want to talk about, but because this system is so heavily subsidized in terms of all the grains that go in to feed these animals and into the farms and factory farms themselves, meat is relatively cheap in this country. It's gone up recently, partly because of ethanol. The corn, the demand for corn has been diverted, and the drought, of course, has made corn prices go up. So every time corn and soybean prices go up, chicken, beef, and pork prices also go up. So beef is pretty high right now, but chicken and pork is still really cheap. I can go to my supermarket and get chicken legs or pork butt, if I wanted it, for 99 cents a pound. And the irony is, if I want broccoli, it's $1.99 a pound. Now, that's still relatively cheap for our incomes, our average incomes, although families are struggling to feed themselves in this economy, and we have to recognize that. But when you're buying whole chicken sometimes for 59 cents a pound, and you can get a chicken for like $2.50, $3, you have to ask yourself, A, wasn't that chicken's life worth more than $3? And B, something is wrong when it only costs $3 to raise and sell a chicken that size.
And not only that, most of what's being fed to these animals is genetically modified soy and corn, correct?
You know, that's a really good question, and I don't know the answer. Mm-hmm. I cannot answer that.
Okay.
Yeah, I think
but I'm sure some of it is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
I have no doubt.
And then
that.
Could we talk about, so what exactly does it mean that farm subsidies, you know, to somebody who's lived in a city all their life and never been on a farm and has never really, what exactly does that mean? Like, who's actually paying for that, and why does that keep things, the food so cheap?
And I also wanted to ask about, you know, who are the industrial farmers? Are these folks who at one time had a more traditional farming operation, felt economic pressure, and then had modernized and adapted their farming practices to compete in an environment like you described? Or is this actually something that businessmen and women came in and started from scratch?
The former, in your question, Kevin. It was businessmen that came in from places like St. Louis and Chicago and even New York at companies like Cargill and ADM and even Purina, believe it or not, Land of Lakes, Tyson, Purdue, and did convince traditional farmers that the only way to survive, you know, get big or get out, I think was the mantra. And they sold these people a bill of goods, and they went into deep debt often, and some of them are still in debt because they had to build these giant structures according to the corporation's specs. I described this in great detail in Animal Factory. The Purdue farmers on the eastern shore of Maryland are just at the mercy of the company, and whatever the company says they got to do, they got to do it, or they won't get their next contract. And they have to get loans for millions of dollars, not only to build these facilities, but to keep them up to spec at the company's demand. The companies tell you what temperature you keep your barn at. The companies tell you exactly how much water you give to each bird every day. The companies provide you with the feed. You have no choice in what you feed the chickens. They're not your chickens. If you were to eat one of them, you would be arrested and prosecuted. The chicken farmers for Purdue, if they want a chicken, they have to get in the car and go down to the supermarket and buy it at full retail, even though they quite likely raised that chicken themselves and maybe got 50 cents for that chicken. They're going to pay $7.25 or $5.25 or whatever it costs in the market that day for the chicken. In terms of Sam's question, yeah, the subsidies, you know, it's all about the farm bill, and usually when you say farm bill, you can almost hear people's eyes glaze over. They just don't want to know about it. They just don't care, but they really, really should. And the vast majority of farm subsidies these days, and we're talking like $10, $20 billion a year, you know, if we're serious about cutting the budget, this would be one way to start. The vast majority goes to large industrial operations, mostly, like I said, to corn and soybean producers, the biggest ones, which then that goes to feed animals in factory farms, so it keeps the price of feed down for factory farms and allows them to operate more efficiently. Factory farms themselves also get direct subsidies from the government, and they also get price supports and insurance support and other tax credits and things like that. That does add up into the billions and billions of dollars. And what's just so perverse about the whole system is if you look at the percentage of our money, our taxpayer money, going to support various parts of agriculture and subsidies, something like 80% goes to produce meat and dairy, either through these grains fed to animals or direct subsidies to meat and dairy producers. 80%.
That's huge.
Then maybe like another 15% goes to, I think it's like rice and sugar and cotton and, you know, things that just aren't really particularly healthy to eat. And then it's like, it's just, I think when, by the time you get down to fruits and vegetables, you know, there's other grains, there's seeds, there's nuts. And when you get down to that level, we're talking 1 or 2% of every dollar spent in subsidies goes to vegetables, which is why broccoli is $1.99 and pork butt is 99 cents. But if you look at, this is all USDA calculated, this USDA parcels out these millions of dollars. But if you look at their food pyramid, it's the complete inversion in terms of what you should eat. 80% of what you should eat is supposed to be plant-based. And at the very, very top of the pyramid is meat and dairy. And yet, if you look at the subsidies, it's the exact inversion of that. And it's you know, by subsidizing meat and dairy and making it cheap, we are encouraging overconsumption of animal protein, which leads to obesity, diabetes, heart disease, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I'm not a vegetarian, but we, you know, we eat too much animal protein in this country and too much animal fat. And part of it's because it's cheap. My nephew tells me, you know, when they're low on money, they eat pork because it's the cheapest thing in the supermarket.
So it's not good for the people who are eating it. It's not really, you know, at the levels that we're eating it, and it's not really good for the animals. And I'm going to get to that in a minute and talk about some of the conditions that the animals live under. So any sense on, I mean, is it just come back to the almighty dollar? Because, and even the farmers who are raising these animals are not, I mean, they're, like as you were saying, they're in incredible levels of debt. So just these big corporations are profiting from that. And then also other big corporations are profiting then to treat the humans who have these chronic diseases and need to be on medications for the rest of their lives to control these kinds of things. So is this what's driving it? And do you see any potential that this is going to change?
Well, what's driving it, you know, is definitely profit, but it's also a self-satisfied rationale that this is the only way we're going to feed the world. This is the only way we're going to feed the country. The industry brags that only 2% of the population feeds 100% of the population. In a time where we're still in a jobs crisis, where millions and millions of people are out of work, to brag about how few people you employ is just, you know, it just tells you where they're at in their minds. They want the most efficient profit-generating stream that they can have.
Did you look at how things operate in other countries when you were researching this book? I'm just curious about, we had a while back, we had someone in here who was, his family was basically artisanal meat product makers, as he grew up in Europe, and, you know, he was actually making products that were grown up on small family farms, and products that took time to make they weren't using artificial preservatives or all natural methods in order to make the meat products.
Traditional curing processes.
His name is Francois Vecchio. Yeah. He's known as the poet of pork around here, and this was in Europe. And it seems like that method works for Europe, and people are willing to pay more money for quality in other countries. So I'm wondering if you had any experience looking into that compared to what we do here.
Yeah, are these practices being modeled in other countries?
Yeah, well, first of all, Europe is, or at least parts of Europe, is exemplary in terms of small artisanal farms that still thrive, that still get products to market. The UK has no factory farms. They tried to open up a mega dairy there, and people were so up in arms that actually they abandoned the project. Italy, of course, is famous for local agricultural products and animal products that are sustainably raised and have been raised that way for hundreds of years, and frankly, they're delicious. But Eastern Europe is a different story. Poland, particularly, is filled with factory farms now, and a lot of that meat makes its way into the grocery stores across Europe and probably even over here. We just had the big horse meat scandal going across Europe, and it showed up in IKEA meatballs here. Yeah. So, no one's, the global economy, nobody's immune to that. Mexico and Brazil have adopted the factory farm model extensively, and a lot of them are actually owned by North American corporations. China, Korea, I believe countries like Thailand now all have huge factory farm systems. So it's a mixed bag around the world. I would say the U.S. is the most mechanized, the most industrialized, the most vertically integrated, which is something we haven't quite talked about, but that means where the companies own the animal, as they say, from semen to cellophane. In other words, from the second that animal is conceived to ending up on the supermarket shelf, it is owned by the company. And if you think about a Tyson chicken or a Cargill ham or a Smithfield ham that you'll see in your supermarket with the Smithfield brand, that was raised on the factory farm by a contractor, by some guy who thought, I'm going to get into this, pig business. And the company owns the animal and all the way from raising it to feeding it to slaughtering it to marketing it. And it leaves very little room for small independent producers to get into the market. And that's particularly true with any animal product. Eggs, dairy, meat. You can't just slaughter your cow and take it down to the supermarket and expect them to wrap it up and sell it for you. It's not going to happen.
There's a couple of things in there I just want to draw out. One is that, we can become so isolated from the reality of what it is that we're buying in the store. And not only that, I'm thinking about these corporations that you've listed off are all publicly traded, mostly publicly traded companies that are probably in most mutual fund portfolios. So it's so deeply the sort of tentacles of this whole machine is so, it's so deeply entrenched in the structures of our culture, supported from the political and from the consumer and from the investment and we're all implicated in a way in this. And there's another part of it, which is, it assumes that a chicken is a chicken. If it looks like a chicken, if it tastes like a chicken, it must be a chicken. And the same thing with beef or an apple. And it's this kind of reducing things to objects that there's not a discernment in there, that a chicken that's humanely raised, that's raised well, and that's living a natural life in a whole life, is going to impart a different degree of nutrition and goodness to the consumer. And And increasingly that's happening. I mean, people are really going to small farms and trying to find wholesome sources of protein. But there's a psychological shift that I think needs to happen where people, where the consumers develop discernment in what they're actually buying and that it reflects their values as human beings. And then lastly, I wanted to add in a little note from St. Francis, just because, you know, Francis is the buzzword of the week with the new pope. But he's got a famous quote where he says, if you want to understand the character of a man, look how he treats animals. And I'm wondering, what does that say about us? You know, that we reduce animals to these objects that we push around in various ways, so that we can have a hamburger.
Well, you know, those are just terrific questions. And yeah, I'm a East Coast, West Coast boy. But when I did this book, I spent just weeks on end in the Midwest and North Carolina and basically, you know, Washington State and other places. But a lot of time in the Midwest. And I talked to people who ran factory farms. I talked to people, all kinds of people, on all sides of the issue. But the people who supported the factory farms were good Christians. They go to church every Sunday. They read the Bible. They're in prayer groups. You know, they consider themselves godly people. And you gently try to broach that question. I wish I'd had the St. Francis quote. I should have brought that up. But it's obvious what the Bible says about treating animals, and yet there is this disconnect. There is this treating them as objects, and there is a defense, because I think the Bible says that God gave man dominion over the animals. So people, you know, use that as a rationale. Well, we have dominion. And by the way, the Amish are the worst offenders just about of anybody. I went to Amish factory. I was just, you expect the Amish to raise animals in beautiful pastoral settings. They don't.
Oh, my God.
That's really surprising.
I bought Amish cheese like 2 days ago. I really did. I thought I was doing something good.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I don't mean to disparage the Amish, but they don't raise their animals in, you know, any other different way. I guess they don't use electricity, but they're still raised in concentrated, you know, feedlots. And it's an excellent question, and it's completely contradictory, and it gets to the point of how we distance ourselves from our food that was once alive. You know, you don't buy a pig's head in the market. And yet you'll go to a top-end gourmet store and get, you know, pig jowls, which is a little piece of a pig head, and pay top dollar for it, you know, if you know what I'm saying. So we have this weird thing where, and even the English language is geared towards, we don't eat pig, we eat pork. We don't eat cow, we eat beef. You know, fish and chicken are different, but those are fowl and fish, but in terms of mammal, we don't eat deer, we eat venison. So we separate ourselves already just in terms of that. And then when we go to the supermarket, we don't see a cow, we don't see a chicken, we see a nice leg or breast, you know, wrapped up in cellophane with a price tag on it. And I think, and, you know, of course, in most supermarkets, when you go to the dairy section, there's a picture above with a cow in a pasture by a barn with flowers. You know, it's all very pretty. But, of course, unless you're buying organic milk, that's not where it came from. And I do think that if we did connect the consumer much more directly and viscerally to where their food was coming from, so that you had the cow in the pasture over the organic milk, and then the cow in this 21st century Stanley Kubrick factory farm.
Matrix, yeah.
You know, with the commercial milk, or the pig, or the chicken, people would say, you know what, I even though it's a sacrifice,
I'm going to pay more money.
I'm going to pay a couple bucks more.
All right, we want to interrupt you just for a moment. We're going to take a short break, and we'll be right back with David Kirby. We're talking about his book Animal Factory and factory farming and how it affects everything. So we'll be right back.
You're listening to Radio Free Palmer, KVRF 89.5 on your FM dial. If you'd like to get involved with community radio, contact us at radiofreepalmer.org. This is your chance to invent community radio in Sutton, Chickaloon, Butte, Palmer, and the surrounding areas.
Welcome back to The Bridge to Everywhere with New York Times bestselling author David Kirby. We're speaking about factory farming and your health. And one thing that just came in, a question from Michelle Bolo. She wants to know what's done with the vast amounts of fecal waste that factory farms create. How does that affect the environment?
Yeah, you know, we haven't gotten there yet, and that was 40-50% of my book. But the working title of my book at the beginning was Poop, because which probably might have sold more copies than it was titled that. But, I mean, it's just a great question, because, again, feeding, when you feed so many animals in such concentrated numbers, you create tons and tons and tons of poop, and you have to do something with it. In a traditional farm, the way a farm worked for tens of thousands of years is that you rotated your animals out on pasture, so your animals would go out and eat the vegetation on that acre, and then they would poop and pee it out right there back into the dirt from which it came. So you are returning those nutrients right back into the soil, which feeds the next generation of weeds and grass and clover, which then comes up and feeds the animals, and then gets returned to the soil as a perfect closed system. It is agronomic. It's beautiful. It worked for thousands of years. What a factory farm does is, because you have so many animals concentrated in one place, even if you're growing crops around that barn, that house where all these animals are kept, you generate so much waste. It's far more nutrients than that land can support. And so, first of all, you have a storage problem, because you can't possibly get rid of all of this manure at once, so you have to keep it somewhere. And the way they have designed their farms is to mix it with water and to store it in these giant lagoons. That causes anaerobic decomposition, which causes off-gassing of all kinds of horrible things like methane and hydrogen sulfide and ammonia. These things can drift for miles and miles and miles. They cause all kinds of health problems. The vast majority, again, of my book was not just about the poop, but was about the people who have to live near the poop and deal with the health issues. They have to deal with the odor, and the odor, it can be literally, you will double over and throw up when the wind comes your way. If you live near, I was at, you know, pig farms in Indiana, Ohio, Michigan, Illinois, and I would go out to these people's, you know, house, and sometimes I would get there and it would smell perfectly fine, and they would apologize. Oh, we're so sorry, because usually it smells awful. But then, sure enough, the wind would shift, and the smell of the feces of 10,000 pigs is something that you just can't even imagine. And, you know, I went to sustainable farms where the pigs live outside and they live on pasture and they live in pens. And pigs, believe it or not, do not defecate where they live. They're actually pretty clean animals. And they go in a corner. And if it's outside, it's mixed with straw and it decomposes in the sun. And frankly, it smells earthy. It's just not. And then you smell this toilet that is a lagoon filled with pig waste. And then, of course, like I said, there's the off-gassing. Hydrogen sulfide can make you depressed, crazy, suicidal. Methane can kill you in certain concentrations. And ammonia not only affects your eyes, nose, throat, and lungs, but it can travel 50 miles downwind and then settle back down to the ground. And if it goes into water, it converts right into nitrogen. And then you have algae blooms, which then create fish kills. So you might have a pond and wake up one day and all the fish in your pond are dead and washed up on your beach, and it's because of a factory farm 50 miles upwind from you. Then you have the diseases, the communicable diseases that, that come out of factory farms, things like MRSA, swine flu, mad cow, well, we'll get to mad cow disease, other diseases that are just carried by people who are exposed to these animals, and then, of course, these animals are given antibiotics, not to treat them for disease, but to prophylaxis against disease and also to promote growth. So they're given sub-therapeutic levels of antibiotics, so the antibiotics are much more, or the pathogens are much more likely to become resistant to these drugs. That's where MRSA comes from. And then you have the direct threat to people from the food itself. A lot of commercial pork does have MRSA in it. We've seen salmonella routinely pop up. We had a half a billion eggs recalled 2 years ago, 3 years ago. We have listeria. We have E. coli. We have people dying from eating hamburger meat. And we do have BSE, bovine spongiform encephalopathy, that these cows, their meat occasionally gets into the system. And the threat to the environment, the threat to public health, look at the swine flu epidemic that I believe arose out of Smithfield-owned factory farms in Mexico. And even though, thank God, it turned out not to be the killer virus that, that we were told, we spent billions of dollars on a vaccine. It caused tens of billions of dollars in economic disruption. It did kill thousands of people. It made tens of thousands of people sick. And that was just sort of a dress rehearsal. Next time could be the real deal. And, you know, we're risking so much for 99 cent a pound pork and good stock returns for Smithfield that, you know, we just don't consider the hidden cost when we go to the supermarket. We don't realize that we're polluting the water and the air and the land. We don't realize that we're making people sick who live near these factory farms. We don't realize that we're bringing pathogens into our homes that if we cut our finger while we're slicing raw pork, we may get MRSA, and that can kill you. You know, it probably won't, but it can. So the hidden costs of this system are vast.
So, yeah, one thing that, that comes right out the top with you talking, you know, since you said that the working title was poop, I mean, this is a great example of poop rolls downhill, first of all. I mean, where does it go? It goes everywhere. We all have to deal with the poop. But clearly the cheap chicken is not the cheap chicken. You know, it's an illusion that we're getting this meat cheaply, because what you're talking about billions of dollars to deal with the after effects, and then billions of dollars
environmental cost,
yeah, everything. So
cost at the level of community local economies.
Mm-hmm. So there's that, and then I want to go back to the mad cow issue, because my understanding was that the reason it hasn't technically shown up in our food supply is because we don't actually test for it. Is that true, or are we actually testing for it now?
We test. I think when I wrote the book, we were testing one in every 10,000 cows.
Mm-hmm.
So that's not very many.
Uh-huh. Well, when you consider that hamburger, like your average hamburger, is not just from one cow. I think what people don't seem to understand is that when you buy supermarket hamburger, you're not just getting burger that was ground up from one cow. From what you could have thousands of cows, right, mixed together in that one hamburger. So,
right? and the don't forget the mixer itself,
mm-hmm,
mixed thousands more cows.
Right.
So.
Right.
If there was a dangerous prion anywhere in,
mm-hmm,
there,
yep,
it could, you know, and like, I don't want to, you know, cause too much alarm about that cow.
We're all panicking. Everybody's running around here in Palmer, Alaska.
I mean,
yeah.
The funny thing about mad cow is, you know, when they found the first one and then the second one, it was headline news. It was 24/7, you know, oh my God, mad cow. And by the way, most mad cow is found in dairy cows, mm-hmm. which we can talk about in a second. Okay. But of course, when dairy cows dry up, they get ground up into hamburger. Most hamburger is used up, dried up dairy cow, just so you know.
Great.
Which is why Angus is such a big deal.
Uh-huh.
But anyway, it was actually about a year or so ago, just a tiny little news brief on Google News. I think it was the 19th mad cow was detected. You know, so now we're up to number 19 and nobody cares.
Right, but
so
but like, that's
like
really not,
day.
Based on how much we test, that's not really representative of what's out there. And did you research what the, has anybody come up with a cause? I mean, I've heard people say organophosphates that they're spraying the, you know, on the, you know, chemicals are spraying on the stuff that they're feeding to the animals. And then, you know, there's this prion, is that how you say it? That it's associated with the mad cow disease, but, or is it the practice of feeding cow parts to cows or sheep parts to sheep? You know, what exactly is the cause of that?
No,
feeding animals to themselves.
Right.
And that's where I was kind of going with some of this. And you mentioned chicken poop.
Mm-hmm.
That, believe it or not, comes into the story, and you're going to gag.
Great.
But there are three ways that we feed cows to cows still in this country, legally, despite attempts at the FDA and the USDA to stop it. It still goes on. One is dairy cows, and I've seen this. I went. You asked me when we were at break if I've ever been to any factory farms. The only ones I went to were sort of the model farms that they want you to see. And there's a giant 30,000 cow dairy farm in Indiana. I think it's called Fair Oaks, and they have this. Like I mentioned, Stanley Kubrick. They have a carousel that holds like 180 cows. That get milked automatically as this thing revolves. And then when they're done, they get off, and another one gets into that slot. And they're just milking three times a day, each cow, constantly. And then they have something called the birthing barn, where they bring school kids in to watch these poor cows on a stage behind glass giving birth to their calves. And the second the calf is born, they snatch it away from the mother.
Wow.
And the mother is crying and mowing and lowing. It's just, it is so heartbreaking. And immediately they stick a bottle into that calf's mouth. Because mother's milk, that's a commodity. They're not going to waste that on a calf.
So the calf doesn't even get the colostrum? The calf doesn't even get the colostrum?
No. No, nothing, nothing. The calf never feeds from its mother. And what is in that formula? It's dried. A lot of it is blood meal, cow blood meal. So this is one reason why dairy cows are much more susceptible to mad cow.
Got it.
Because they're raised on cow blood meal. The second way we feed cows to cows is restaurant scraps. A lot of that gets put into cattle feed. And, of course, a lot of that is beef. And it's perfectly legal. And the third way, which is the most disgusting way, is in the chicken factory farms. Well, chicken poop is super, super high in nitrogen. And it also often contains arsenic. And it's just very, very hard to dispose of. You can't burn it. It's too toxic. You can only spread a certain amount onto the land without basically killing it. And then you have all this leftover chicken poop. And what do they do with it? They feed it to cattle. So oftentimes if there's large chicken-producing areas, you will have cattle feedlots. They don't feed them exclusively chicken poop, but they mix it in with the feed. And the problem with that is in the chicken factories, they feed the chickens on these belts, these mechanical belts, usually, or sometimes just areas where feed is left, and the chickens peck on it, and a lot of it falls into their litter. Well, we feed beef byproducts to chickens in their feed. That's a very common thing to do. So when these chickens are pecking at their food, the beef pellets fall into their litter. That litter is then scooped up and fed to the cows. So they're not only eating chicken crap, they're eating beef byproducts.
David, you wrote Animal Factory, and it was published in 2010. Have things changed since then? Do you, any sign of these practices changing? Is there pressure from the movement, the local movement, and CSAs and people really wanting sustainable products for themselves and for their families?
Yes, there is movement on the consumer side, absolutely. Last night I went out to dinner in Manhattan. It was not cheap, but one of the hottest chefs in Manhattan, David Chang, he has a chain of restaurants called Momofuku, and it's largely pork-based, and frankly, it was absolutely delicious, but it's all sustainable upstate Hudson Valley pork that's raised in you know, the most, you know, impeccable way, and I'm sure vegetarians don't want to hear that, but that's what it was, and the place was packed, and the food co-ops are packed, and the farmers markets are packed, and any restaurant that advertises itself as local, you know, it's amazing that the coffee houses say, you know, our milk came from 50 miles away. You know, like people are really, you know, starting to demand more sustainable, more humanely raised, non-factory farm raised. So that's changing. On the sort of political and policy front, the Obama administration has been a total failure. I've lost complete faith in them. I had some hopes, and they certainly campaigned against factory farming, and Obama did, and has done nothing, which basically leaves it up to citizens to try to police these things. And there have been some successes in the courts where people have won Clean Water Act suits, and they've won nuisance suits. You know, it's not legal for your neighbor to pollute the air on your property to the point where you can no longer go outside and hang laundry on the line or have a picnic or enjoy your property at all. That's goes back to English common law. It's just not permissible. So people are kind of winning on some of those fronts. But what is really going to shut down this system is a crisis. And it's going to be one of two things, or maybe both. One is, as I mentioned, an epidemic of biblical proportions, some super virus or super bacteria, super resistant, rising up out of one of these places, perhaps a avian pig influenza virus that we've never seen before, that will kill tens of thousands of people, if not more, or equally likely is a steep rise in energy costs to the point where it's just no longer sustainable to raise animals in this environment. If you think about the amount of electricity these things use for heating, cooling, lighting, ventilation, automation of the watering systems and the computer systems and the milking systems and the feeding systems, and everything is mechanized and everything is electronic, and it just takes huge amounts of power to run them, whereas that farm I mentioned, that sustainable farm where the animals poop right into the soil and then the soil produces the vegetation which feeds the animals, those farms are actually making profits right now because they don't need electricity, they don't need fertilizer, they don't need antibiotics, they don't need growth hormones. Everything works as it's supposed to, and they save so much money on their input because all they need is rain and sunshine and their land, and it all works according to plan. And they save so much money on all of those chemicals, all of those fertilizers, all of those drugs, that they not only turn a profit, they get a premium for their product because it was raised in such a natural way.
I'm also thinking, when you're speaking about, probably some of our listeners have watched the movie Food Inc. or read the book Omnivore's Dilemma, and in that book is and the movie Joel Salatin from Polyface Farms, who talks about how basically on the farm his animals do all the work. You know, and he's got an amazing example of exactly what you said. You know, a farm that works that way, that ultimately, from what you're saying, we're going to have to move back that way, or we're risking a huge, we already have a huge environmental disaster on our hand, but we're risking something of biblical proportions if we don't shift soon.
Yes and no, because we cannot feed the world tomorrow in a sustainable model, unfortunately. And population is growing, and incomes are growing, and people in developing countries want meat. They want cheese. They want eggs. They want protein. And it just can't happen overnight. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. It's not going to happen overnight. So I think the next step would be some kind of mixed model, because, you know, I try to buy sustainable protein as much as I can, but I'm a freelance writer, and sometimes, you know, sometimes times are tough, and it's really tempting to just go, well, you know, screw it. I'm going to get the 69-cent a pound chicken because I'm not feeling particularly rich right now, and I don't have a family to feed. So the point is, you really have to guard against being smug and elitist and saying, well, you know, I can afford, you know, $5 a dozen eggs. Why don't you, you know? Well, if you got a family of six to feed every day, $5 a dozen eggs, you know, start to add up.
Yeah, in the back of the book, I think you have a list of the cost of what it would cost to get eggs, milk, butter, cheese, bacon, pork chops, chicken, beef, you know, from a factory farm versus, you know, organically produced, and it's quite a bit different. And so for families watching their budget, it's pretty tough to argue with the numbers. But we'd like to shift right now to just talk about a little bit what you've been doing recently, because you've and you were talking about that you're a writer, but you've also just recently started a media coaching business called David Kirby Coaches. And we wanted to talk for the last 10 minutes a little bit about what you're doing with that and what your vision is for that new business that you're moving into.
Thanks for asking, Sam. But I do also just want to plug one more time Death at SeaWorld.
Uh-huh. Because please do.
It is my most recent book, and you are a major character in it, and I'm really proud of it. And I'm very excited because this incredible documentary is coming out this summer called Blackfish, at the same time that my book is coming out in paperback, and we hope to do some co-marketing things and co-promotional.
And we will absolutely have you back on the show when Blackfish premieres. Blackfish will premiere in probably the end of July, and at that point we'll have you back on the show, and we'll devote an entire show to Death at SeaWorld. But for those of you who haven't read the book, Death at SeaWorld, it's fantastic, and it's a behind-the-scenes look at what goes on in the captive marine mammal entertainment industry.
It's a true game changer. It's going to change the way people across this country look at marine parks like SeaWorld. It literally will change the way things are going.
Well, thank you. And I hope that the film and the paperback feed off each other, and really we reach some kind of critical mass. But maybe you can do the show live from New York during the premiere.
That sounds like fun. I think our engineer is shaking his head yes. He would love that if we could do that. So we'll definitely give that a shot.
Hey, David, before we go into your media coaching, I want just a quick question on the farms. Is there a brand that you feel you could trust? I mean, is Organic Family Farms, you know, is a co-op, and there's various farms represented by that brand. Is there any single one that you feel confident in, and then we can move into your...
Yeah, well, I don't know that brand because we don't have that here. Most of our organic dairy comes from Vermont, and I think it's called Organic Valley, and I love it, and I trust it, and I buy it. Instead of a brand, you really want to look for a label. One classification is called Certified Humane, and I feel pretty good about buying something that has the Certified Humane label on it. The real standard, if you really want to be strict, is the Animal Welfare Approved label, the AWA, from the Animal Welfare Institute. They have different standards. Organic also, for the most part, that animal was raised fairly humanely with a minimum of standards to so instead of the brand, I look for those types of labels. People on the East Coast, if they know chicken, Murray's Chicken is certified humane, and it's kind of a cool company. Now, it's mostly Mennonite farmers in Pennsylvania, but what they do is that there's a little number on your package of chicken, and you go online and you pull it up, and you can see the farm where that chicken was raised, and they even have a Google Earth photo.
Wow.
And you can see the little chickens out on the pasture. It's really pretty funny.
That's cool. They do something similar in Europe with eggs, where you can find where your individual egg came
That's
from.
That's right. Yes, yeah. You can. Yes, you can. So instead of brands, you know, I really look for labels and organic, certified humane, and animal welfare are the three biggies.
That's really helpful. So let's talk a little bit about, we have about 5 minutes, so we just want to get a general overview about, 3 minutes, actually. So in 3 minutes, just give us a little, and we'll definitely have you back on the show, but just a little bit about what you're doing with the media coaching.
And definitely finish up with how folks can follow up with you.
Yeah, especially if they'd like to take advantage of your services.
Sure. Thank you so much. Yeah, I mean, I realize I've been in this business for about 30 years. I've been in every kind of media you can name. Newspaper, magazine, radio, TV, online, new media, I mean, everything. And I've been on TV, I've been a public relations specialist, I've been a media trainer, an author, a journalist. And I realized that I have a lot of experience to share with people, and I know that people struggle with writing, and I know that there's a writer in everybody, but they feel intimidated. And frankly, we don't learn English grammar in school anymore. We don't learn the real mechanics of English composition. People don't know how to express themselves well, and when I see people writing, I'm frankly embarrassed for them because they don't know the basic rules. And so I decided, why not set up a consulting company where I work with people one-on-one, and it's only about a week or two old since I've officially launched. I've signed up maybe a dozen clients. They run the gamut. People, you know, from major universities to aspiring writers to nonprofit organizations that need help. And I get on the phone with them and I work with them. And we, instead of just writing things for them or rewriting their stuff or editing their stuff, I walk them through it. And I think they come out of the experience better writers. They are surprised that the comma goes within the quotation marks. You know, I hear that all the time. No, I didn't know that. Nobody ever told me that. But you don't learn that stuff in school. And you, to be a good writer and to write professionally and to look good, you need to know those, you know, very basic rules. And I help people with their structure, with storytelling, with short storytelling, with novels, with nonfiction, with press releases. I'm working with an amazing company that's doing a startup for fermented food, for health, including to recover the gut health of kids with autism. People with just amazing ideas that don't quite know how to put it all down on paper, and I help them. And I find it's really rewarding to help people, and it makes my writing better, so I'm grateful to them.
We're coming down to the last 10 seconds, so could you just say where, we've got it on our website, but just say where people would go to get in touch with you to follow up?
That's davidkirbycoaches.com.
Awesome. Thank you so much, David Kirby, for joining us. David Kirby's the author of Evidence of Harm, Animal Factory, and Death at SeaWorld. And we're so grateful that he was able to join us on the show tonight to speak about factory farming. And have a great night, everyone.
Thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, David.
Good night.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us on The Bridge to Everywhere, broadcasting on KVRF 89.5 Big Cabbage Radio in Palmer, Alaska. Like us on Facebook at Bridge to Everywhere to access more information, links, and resources from our guests and show topics.